Democracy may be one of the best things that humans have ever done. But what hope do we have of keeping it? If there isn't hope, who's going to show up in democracy's defense? In today's episode, we'll watch Plato go head-to-head with Norman Rockwell, analyze a graph, check in with Barbara Kingsolver and a Martian. This is episode 2 of a 4-part series on democracy. It's I Heart This, everybody. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. There's an old Norman Rockwell painting of a young man standing to speak in a crowded New England meeting house. He stands tall, confident expression, his face upturned. Given the context, he's probably addressing a select board, but with his face illuminated from above, you wonder if he is also speaking to some kind of higher power. His hands are dirty, and so is the plaid shirt and half-buttoned jacket with a town report folded in its pocket. Around him, tidy men in suit coats and ties look at him with respect, the respect that a fellow citizen is due. The painting is called Freedom of Speech. I first saw it when I was 12. And as a boy, that painting captured how I thought democracy worked. People got informed. They studied issues and considered arguments from multiple sides. They wrestled with moral ambiguities and tried to keep their minds open. Someone stood up, without fear, to speak their truth. The crowd listened, even if the speaker was just a young guy with dirt under his nails. This all seems like a naive fairy tale to me now. The psychologist Steven Pinker would call it a civics class idealization of democracy, in which an informed populace deliberates about the common good and carefully selects leaders who carry out their preferences. By that standard, he says, the number of democracies in the world is zero in the past, zero in the present, and almost certainly zero in the future. Ah! So cynical. I hate it. But man, the evidence is disappointingly convincing. In wide-ranging and well-replicated studies, psychologists have shown that humans are experts at distorting the truth. Confront us with evidence contrary to our beliefs, and instead of getting curious, we get defensive. Instead of using reason to find the faults in our perspective, we use it as a weapon to attack our opponents. And being smart is no defense. In fact, the smarter we are, the more likely we are to fool ourselves. Studies suggest that our tendency to divide people into us and them is hardwired into our genes and our brain. We are born to make enemies. A 2017 study convincingly showed that we even take greater delight in the losses of our enemies than we do in the victories of our friends. Social science suggests that we also suck as an electorate, and not just Americans, and not just one side of some so-called political aisle. All of us. We know woefully little about history and law and the environment and economics. We are more likely to be influenced by negative attack ads than we are to consider the qualifications of a candidate for office. Instead of listening to alternative viewpoints, we avoid and attack them. We seek out news and even friends who reinforce our beliefs, repeat a lie often enough, and we believe it. This evidence might be new, but the arguments against democracy are as ancient as civilization itself. In the Republic, the world's oldest surviving work of political philosophy, Plato makes a long and convincing case that democracy contains the seeds of its own undoing. His argument is long, but two thought experiments feel particularly prescient. First, Plato says, imagine a ship setting out across a treacherous sea. Who would you want in charge of that ship? Random stranger off the street or an expert mariner? Plato argues that, of course, we want the mariner. We want the guy who knows how to read the tides and the winds. We want the guy who's been through storms and has lived to tell the tale. Why then, he asks, would you turn the helm of your government over to all of these uninformed laypeople? Governing, like sailing, takes skill and training and practice, and yet in democracy, every random bloke on the street has a hand on the tiller. In his second thought experiment, Plato asks us to imagine an electorate of children considering two candidates. One is a doctor, and one is the owner of a local candy shop. Who wins, he asks us. Is it the candidate that tells us we should eat our vegetables and gives us foul-tasting medicine? Or is it the guy who passes out the sweets? Vote for me and you'll get all the sweets you want. Forget about sacrificing for the future and all the hassle of brushing your teeth. You can have what you want. You deserve what you want. Vote for me and you can have it. The doctor loses every time. I'm not a huge fan of Plato. I think he's a condescending didact, but I can't discount his point. We the people usually don't know what's best for us and are easily taken in by hucksters. As patronizing as he is, he's probably right. We are short-sighted, vindictive, and ignorant. We are, after all, only human. I spent the last episode of I Heart This appreciating the awesomeness of democracy, and I sincerely believe that democracy is awesome. But frankly, a reminder of democracy's awesomeness isn't what I need right now. I'm not taking democracy for granted. What I need is hope that my democracy will survive. On the morning of November 6th, I woke up expecting not to know the results of the election. I thought there would be days or weeks of lawsuits and recounts, so I didn't even check the news. I took a shower, got dressed, emptied the dishwasher. By 6:30, I hadn't seen Lori yet, and thinking she'd overslept, I went upstairs to wake her. And I found her still in bed, her laptop open and her head in her hands, and I didn't even need to ask. Just looking at her, I knew. That moment of me standing in that dark room, seeing Laura cradling her head in her hands, illuminated by the screen of her laptop, that was the low point of my faith in democracy. This isn't because I'm liberal or progressive. I think America needs a strong Republican Party, one that stands for integrity and personal responsibility, just like we need a Democratic Party that stands for extending liberty and equity to people who haven't had it in the past. My despair wasn't about a liberal-conservative divide. It was about my fear of the anti-democratic ethos of the Trump administration. I am deeply afraid that it will undermine trust in our electoral process. It will use the FBI and Justice Department to go after personal adversaries. We'll use the threat of lawsuits to silence the free press. We'll gut agencies that execute laws they don't like instead of actually working to change the laws. We'll intimidate opponents with frivolous lawsuits. And we'll demonize and slander opponents instead of engaging with them in debate. If you believe that the Trump administration is good for democracy, welcome. I am glad you are listening. I sincerely hope that you are right and that my fears are unjustified. I really, really do. But if I'm going to talk honestly about democracy, I have to talk about these fears. Because when I came around the corner and saw Laura's face in her hands, that's when my faith in the democracy of that Norman Rockwell painting hit rock bottom. All I could see was Plato's purveyor of sweets. And the next step, Plato assures us, is tyranny. In the weeks that followed the election, people around me went through the motions of their daily lives with stricken looks on their faces. They seemed tired, like marathoners at the 20th mile, completely exhausted and wondering how they could still have so far to go. For my part, I would startle awake at 3 o'clock in the morning and lie in bed until dawn, chastising myself for all the political action I could have taken and had failed to do, trying to chase Plato out of my head as he kept saying, "Tyranny, by its very nature, arises from democracy." I began writing these podcast episodes as an antidote to my insomnia. All these repetitive thoughts spilled onto the page, and I would rearrange them like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, looking for some kind of meaning. That went on for most of December. Then one day, while laying out the fragments of my writing on sticky notes across the kitchen table, a new question occurred to me. If Plato was right, why do democracies exist at all? They should be uncommon and short-lived. They should sink back into tyranny every time they arise. But do they? How do you even track the democraticness of the world? How do you even tell how democratic a country is? The best data I could find came from something called the Varieties of Democracy Project. It's a global team of thousands of wonks and scholars who have painstakingly given us a portrait of democracy over time. A graphical summary of their work tells a surprising story. You can find a link in our show notes. And here's what it reveals. The world is full of democracies. In 2012, somewhere near half of all the people in the world lived in one. What a heart-stopping achievement. And what democracies they are. They put the democracies of the past to shame. The United States was barely a democracy when it started, with its blatant racism and sexism and codified slavery. Only a small fraction of its citizens could vote. Many of them wouldn't win that right, even on paper, for almost a century and a half. In today's world, wherever there are elections, it is taken for granted, taken as given, that it is wrong to restrict voting rights based on your sex or the color of your skin. If people are so bad at democracy, how did we get here? I fell down a kind of research rabbit hole in my quest to find out. Here's one of my favorite facts of all time, widely understood by anthropologists, but almost completely ignored by pretty much everyone else. Humans were actually born free. We evolved free. Democracy and freedom and a practical kind of anarchy is our natural state. Back in the days when we hunted and foraged for a living, there were almost no headmen or chiefs. Around the world, our ancestors lived mostly without slavery or social class or patriarchy. History and ethnography are full of thousands of examples from cultures across the world, some of which lasted well into the 20th century. There's a bunch of sources on this in my show notes. This wasn't because of some high-minded nobility on the part of our ancestors. It was mostly because people chafe at being ordered around and abused. And if someone in the band got too bossy, people just left to go hunting someplace else. The vast majority of the human story is one of egalitarian bands. The doors to despotism only opened after people became reliant on cereal farming for a living. It turns out that if you are dependent on stored food to survive, then whoever puts a lock on the granary controls you. Kings are not a product of human nature. They are the result of locking up the food. For millennia, empire and civilization were synonymous. So in the year 1750, the number of democracies in the so-called civilized world was effectively zero. If you lived anywhere from Japan to England or from Sweden to Zululand, you lived under a king or an emperor or a monarch or a lord. When the 13 newly emancipated British colonies in the east coast of North America sent delegates to Philadelphia in the hot summer of 1787 to hash out a new constitution, that was the world that they were living in. Many of those delegates would have read Plato, but they would also have had a first-hand familiarity with democracy's blessings. In New England, towns had governed themselves by democratic meetings for 150 years. Their Native American neighbors were a showcase of democratic institutions. But even under British rule, all the colonies had had representative assemblies. It's hard to imagine a more perfect education in democracy's vulnerabilities and promises and practicalities. It may have been the world's first constitutional democracy, but what they came up with that summer wasn't perfect. It wasn't divinely inspired. The founding fathers themselves were skeptical. Many of them had held their noses over the unsavory compromises they had had to make. Many expressed serious regrets and misgivings. And by today's standards, it wouldn't even be considered a democracy. Well, first of all, it was technically a republic. And second, it only extended representation to white landowning men. The founding fathers knew that that government was an experiment. The world, including them, watched uncertainly to see what would happen. But that experiment turned out to be a remarkable achievement. If the monarchs of Europe were waiting for it to fall, they were disappointed. Still, it took a long time for the spread of democracy to gain momentum. That graph of the growth of worldwide democracy over time, it is a long, narrow tail through the 19th century. For most of it, you can hardly see the curve at all. The United States was little more than a curiosity in a world of emperors and kings. That doesn't mean that democratic ideas weren't spreading. They were. As the American experiment challenged a skeptical world, people everywhere began to see that there was an alternative to authoritarian rule. But progress was slow. France spent most of the 19th century somersaulting from democracy to autocracy and back again. Britain crept toward democracy through a maze of bureaucratic reform. But however eccentric their paths, by the end of the 1800s, there were 10 democratic nations. From 1900 on, the trajectory of democracy on that graph is impressive. About 20% of the world's governments by 1950, 30% by the fall of communism in 1989, 40% by 1993, and 54% in 2004. In 100 years, we went from a world where 5% of all nation states were democracies to one where 50% were. 50%! Now that change wasn't linear. Democracy advanced and receded in waves. The first crested in the 1920s, only to break against a rising wall of fascism. After World War II, there was a second wave as countries around the world threw off the shackles of colonial rule, many of them forming democratic or quasi-democratic governments, only to have that wave stall with the spread of Soviet-style communism in the 1960s and 1970s. The most recent wave in democratic progress began in 1989, when I watched the Berlin Wall come down on TV. There is something comforting to me about seeing this history portrayed on a graph. My country's current turn toward authoritarianism and the world's is still frightening, but it looks less apocalyptic when I take this long view. Despite 8 years of backsliding, the world is still more democratic than it was at any point in the 20th century. Even the countries that aren't democratic are less autocratic. Of the world's autocracies, fewer and fewer of them rule with the kind of impunity that the Taliban rules Afghanistan or that Kim Jong-un rules North Korea. I look at that graph and I feel awe and gratitude. Our people did this. Our people did this. Our ancestors built this all around the world. But how? Plato's logic still holds. And now it's even supported by a whole bunch of scientific evidence. I mean, humans clearly suck at democracy, and yet the world hasn't turned out like Plato would have predicted. Somehow, we seem to build democracies despite ourselves. What gives? Why? It's really a good question, isn't it? And once I started asking, I couldn't get out of my head. I think that I secretly dreamed that it might reveal some backdoor way to save my country from sliding back into autocracy. I'll tell you now, I didn't find it. It was unrealistic to think I would. I'm not a political scientist. If such a backdoor way existed, either it would be incredibly hard to find, or surely somebody much smarter and better informed than I would have already found it. But I can tell you, as I continued to mull and write and read, that I found, despite myself, a surprising kind of hope. First, I was caught off guard by just how well democracies have worked. I mean, sure, when the United States began, it was just a jerry-rigged prototype held together by duct tape and compromise. But by the end of the 19th century, it was clear that this prototype had been a resounding success, and not just because it persisted, but also for all the reasons that I talked about in my last episode. Democracies work. They are the most prosperous, best educated, safest, healthiest, and happiest places in all the history of civilization. And that led to their third big success, because once people had seen a working example of democracy in the United States, it awakened dreams of liberty in people around the world. They flocked here. They crowded Ellis Island. And the ones who didn't thought, we could do that. We could have that here. And they got to work. Why didn't they collapse into demagoguery all the time, like Plato predicted? Well, that brought me to my second observation. Democracies learn. Better than any other form of government, they adapt. That's what made the American experiment so successful. Those men gathered at Independence Hall, they knew about Plato's problem. They knew how the ancient Athenian democracy ended up in an oligarchic coup, and how Caesar and his allies subverted the Roman Republic. So they didn't just build a democracy. They tried to build one that would withstand demagogues. They invented something new, a system of checks and balances and multiple branches to rein each other in. But that wasn't their only invention. They knew that the threats to democracy weren't just the ones that they could see. The world was always changing. What couldn't change wouldn't survive. Would-be tyrants, big and small, would always be on the lookout for new ways to throw their weight around. So they built into the Constitution a way to change it, a way to keep on learning. Despite the strange quasi-religious impulse to think of the Founding Fathers as infallible, they knew that they weren't. So they made their new republic open source so that future generations could fix the bugs in the code. And then other countries watched and learned. When they built their democracies, they borrowed these American inventions, and then they continued to innovate. And now, on the Economist Group's Democracy Index, there are 28 countries whose democracy ranking surpasses the United States. Not because they're better than us, but because they learned from us and innovated and built on our example. When I realized this, that democracies get better with the innovations of each new generation, I understood that Plato's critique didn't reveal a fatal flaw in democracy. It's just a design challenge. Perhaps, if we're clever, we can learn from the failures and vulnerabilities of this moment and engineer ways to better withstand them. This doesn't, of course, make things any more okay in the moment. Nor does it change the fundamental basis of Plato's argument. No matter how much you modify and innovate, people will always be fools. We will always be stuck with our own stubbornness and scapegoating and ignorance. And there will always be people inclined to seize power who think that they are the only ones who can save us or make us great. Even if we can engineer democracy to be ever better able to withstand our shortcomings, we can't engineer the shortcomings out of ourselves. But even there, the more I thought, the more I found reason to believe. Even though we are, and probably always will be, a flawed electorate, we are not just flawed. Yes, human beings suck at listening to our opponents, but that doesn't mean we never do. Yes, we are more easily swayed by emotion and bias than we are by reason, but that doesn't mean that reason never wins the day. We are prone to lies and empty promises, but that doesn't mean that we never wake from their spell. To have democracy arise in the first place, somebody had to be better than we expect ourselves to be. People do compromise. People share power when they could seize it. They listen to their opponents, sometimes even their most hated enemies. They concede, even though they don't like what you say, that you have the right to say it. And sometimes they even change their minds. And in election after election around the world, losers have graciously conceded. Democracy is here because sometimes, against the odds, we actually are our best selves. Sometimes we do live up to that Norman Rockwell painting. Despite our sweet tooth, sometimes we choose the doctor. At the time of this recording, it's mid-February. I've spent almost 3 months reading and writing and obsessing about democracy, talking to friends and family, and I am still afraid. When I am feeling that anxiety well up, I turn my gaze back to that graph, showing democracy's long, rocky road here. Democracy is vulnerable, but it is also resilient. More than Plato posited and more than the American founding fathers would have guessed. We have exceeded expectations for 238 years. If democracy is faltering now, that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with us or the people across some imaginary political aisle. We are human. The fact that we've designed a government that withstood our foibles for centuries is a testament to our cleverness. And if we are anything, we are clever. Shortly after Election Day, my daughter tacked a short message from Barbara Kingsolver to her wall. It had come to her by way of a friend who had gotten it from another, passed like a bit of candle flame from one kid to the next. And she'd transcribed it and stuck it right over her bed next to her window, the one where the morning sun comes in. And here's what it says. Truth and love have been smacked down so many times in history before today. Truth because it's inconvenient, and love because it is vulnerable. But truth is like gravity and carbon and the sun behind an eclipse. It's still there. And love stays alive if you tend it like a flame. If you feel crushed by unkindness today, it's a time for grieving, reaching out to loved ones, noticing one bright color somewhere in the day, remembering what there is to love, starting with the immediate, the place and people we can tend ourselves and make safe. We can't save everything all at once, but it's still worth saving something because there are so many of us to do it. And we are all still here today, exactly as we were yesterday, like gravity and carbon and the sun behind an eclipse. When I started all of this, I thought I was looking for something that told me it was all going to be okay. And I never found it. Look, I don't know whether my country will emerge from this moment intact. I don't know if by the time the next election rolls around, there will even be one. I'm not going to get those kinds of assurances. But I wasn't really looking for assurance anyway. I was looking for hope. And hope doesn't mean that it's all going to be okay. Hope means taunting the fates even when you think you know how the story ends. Hope is remembering that the genie of human liberty is out of the bottle. That a world full of people have tasted liberty or have seen others with it, and who, if it came to it, would keep that fire alight in the catacombs and the caves until they could bring it back blazing again. Hope means we've got a shot if we are brave enough to take it. And we do have a shot. The current retreat of democracy is not the first. We have weathered such retreats before and come back stronger because people didn't weather them alone. People helped each other. When there's a disaster, we send aid. When someone is lost, we assemble a search party. When a friend gets sick, we make soup. When democracy falters, we march. We sit in. We boycott. We vote. If you are afraid, you are not alone. There are millions of people around the world who want these democracies to keep working, and who, if they can see that we have a shot at doing so, will do what they can. These past few days, I found myself thinking less about Plato and more about Andy Weir's 2011 novel, The Martian. In it, an astronaut named Mark Watney is stranded and left for dead during an emergency evacuation from one of the first crewed missions to Mars. With only a few weeks of supplies, no hope of communication with his departed crew, and a space agency back on Earth that isn't even looking for him, Mark's odds seem slim. And even if he can survive alone for the next 4 years, He won't be able to leave Mars until he meets the next mission at their landing site, 3,500 kilometers away. Mark's problems are like ours. They're big, they're complicated, they're intimidating. He probably can't solve them. There have been times over the past few months when I felt like the odds for my country were just as long. But as Mark analyzes the problem, looks at the constraints of his limited resources, the amount of food he'll need, the problems and the sub-problems he'll have to solve, he realizes he's got a shot. And he tells himself the same thing that I'm telling myself right now, that a shot is all he needs. As he says in the 2015 film adaptation, "In the face of overwhelming odds, I'm left with only one option. I'm going to have to science the shit out of this. And we're going to have to do the same. It's time to start helping neighbors and solving problems. Hope isn't knowing it's going to turn out okay. Hope is stepping forward to protect what you love, even when you don't know how it's going to turn out." Here's some I Heart This homework for this episode. Think of one thing, just one thing, that reminds you that we have a shot at keeping democracy alive. And then share it with some other human beings. Doesn't matter how. Call your mom, email your boss, send a messenger pigeon, post your one thing on our Facebook page, and we could end up with a kind of collection of hope to keep us moving forward. We'll need each other for this. I Heart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our theme song was used with permission from neosounds.com. New episodes every Wednesday this month. Visit our archive at iheartthispodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook at the I Heart This Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.